Senator McGovern, President Nixon's gradual withdrawal policy in Vietnam seems to have been winning increasing popular support. Now the reported massacre at My Lai has stirred up new emotions in the country. Do you think this incident may bring new pressures on the president for faster withdrawal?
I think what this incident has done, Mr. Herman, is to tear the mask off the war. Many of us have known for a long time that this was a barbaric, self-defeating war in which we had asked young Americans to take on an impossible task, and that's to intervene in an essentially a civil war and try to bring about a political and military conclusion that was acceptable to us. I think that for the first time, millions of Americans are realizing that we have stumbled into a conflict where we not only of necessity commit horrible atrocities against the people of Vietnam, but where, in a sense, we brutalize our own people and our own nation. I think it's more than just Lieutenant Calley involved here. I think a national policy is on trial.
From CBS Washington, In Color, Face the Nation, a spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with Senator George McGovern, Democrat of South Dakota. Senator McGovern will be questioned by CBS News correspondent Bruce Morton. Nick Kotz of the Washington Bureau of the Des Moines Register and Tribune, and CBS News correspondent George Herman. We shall continue the interview with Senator McGovern in a moment.
This is an average American homeowner. And we at Continental Insurance had just borrowed his home full of average American furniture, which we're about to put on his average American lawn. Why? To show you that you own more things than you think. And in case you haven't noticed, things cost more than they used to. Food costs more, furniture costs more, houses cost more. You could never replace all this for what it cost you. So a fire or some other disaster could become a financial disaster, too. A Continental Insurance agent can help prevent that. He'll help you figure out how much all this is worth now. And then he'll make sure high prices don't catch you with your insurance down.
Senator McGovern, you mentioned two factors there. One was Lieutenant Calley, an individual, and the other was a question of sort of collective guilt, whether of the men fighting over there or of the whole nation. Do you think it's possible that the United States might try to purge some of that collective worry, fear, and guilt by giving an unduly harsh sentence to somebody like Lieutenant Calley, trying to make him a scapegoat for all of us?
I think that is possible. Many people will see the lieutenant and his men as a convenient target on which to unload what should be a sense of national guilt. We put these men into a situation where it was almost inevitable that sooner or later events of this kind would take place. This war is unlike any war in which our country has ever been involved. The people that we're fighting against, for the most part, are not in uniform. It's very difficult to tell who is a friend and who is a foe. When someone in a village fires at our troops, or a mine is planted that destroys American troops, the natural reaction is to lash back. In many cases, those actions are carried out by the civilian population in cooperation with the Viet Cong. What disturbs me is that millions of Americans who apparently have not been bothered by the massive bombardment of Vietnam from the air. Let me say, I was a bomber pilot in World War II, but that was at a time when we were aiming those bombs at strategic targets and trying to knock out the Nazi war machine. But in this war, village after village has been leveled to the ground with the slaughter of the innocents and the guilty alike, in many cases without warning. One reporter who has looked very closely at Quang Nai Province, which is the area now under discussion, says that 70% of the villages in that area have been utterly destroyed, including many thousands of innocent people. Now, really, what is the difference between a bombing plane or an artillery piece destroying a village, including its inhabitants, men, women, and children, and what Lieutenant Calley did. The difference, I suppose, is that Lieutenant Calley and his people, if they are guilty as charged, were operating at closer range. But the moral issue, it seems to me, to be the same.
Senator McGovern, you've been a critic of the Vietnam War since 1964, I believe. What do you suggest we do right now? Should we pull all our troops out of Vietnam? What's the answer?
Well, I've suggested, Mr. Kotz, that we take three precautions in the event we decide to disengage, and I think we should decide to disengage. First of all, we ought to deploy our own forces in defensive arrangements. Secondly, we ought to negotiate the mutual release of prisoners on both sides. And third, we ought to make some provision for asylum in friendly countries for those Vietnamese who might be threatened by a withdrawal. Now, those are the points that I think we ought to be negotiating at Paris. And I'm convinced if we understood that the only real factor we have to negotiate is the withdrawal of our forces, that we could bring about those arrangements that I've just suggested. I see no reason why we couldn't completely disengage from Vietnam within a year's time.
Senator, in the past, the Senate has been something of a forum for discussion of Vietnam policy. Lately, it's been very quiet. The Foreign Relations Committee is not having public hearings on Vietnam. What do you think the reasons are for the truce, and do you think there is a role for the Senate at this point?
I think there's a very definite role. I think perhaps the reason why the debate has slowed down somewhat this year in the Senate is that people have felt that a new administration was in power and that they were entitled to some time to develop a different policy. Personally, I'm disappointed that the administration has not moved more quickly than it has to carry out what I believe to be the election mandate of 1968. But I've made a new determination with the revelation of the Pinkville massacre that I'm going to introduce a resolution in the Senate very shortly that would create a select committee to look into the whole process by which we became involved in Vietnam. I think we have to begin looking beyond Vietnam. I'm very concerned about an early disengagement, but more important than that is the question of how we became so deeply involved in a war that we now say we shouldn't have been in and that we're trying to get out of. And I would hope this committee would follow the pattern of the Select Committee on Hunger that I've been privileged to chair, that it would be a strictly bipartisan committee, that it would raise questions about what the assumptions were that first involved us in Vietnam. How did we arrive at those assumptions? What were the decision-making procedures that were followed? Was there proper debate in the Senate? Did we follow the proper constitutional procedures? What were the factors, in short, that involved us in this war? And what lessons does it have to teach us that might enable us to structure a more intelligent foreign policy in the future?
Would it look beyond also to our involvement in Laos and in Thailand to examine them right now?
Well, those examinations are going forward now, Mr. Herman. The subcommittee under Senator Symington of Missouri is looking into that question right now of what our involvement is in Laos and Thailand and elsewhere.
But wouldn't your select committee, which is looking into causes, find perhaps some parallels between Vietnam and Laos and want to examine them together as history?
Yes, I think there would be some overlap there with the work of the Symington Committee, but the essential purpose of the committee that I'm proposing is to look into the whole historical, congressional and constitutional process by which we became involved in a war that I think most Americans now think was a mistake.
Senator, when you call for the creation of a special committee, are not you in effect criticizing the institutions of Congress, the Foreign Relations Committees, the Armed Services Committees, saying that they're not doing their jobs properly?
Well, Mr. Kotz, I don't want to point the finger at any one committee because I think all of us in the Congress have failed on this issue of Vietnam. I'm willing to take my share of the responsibility along with other people in the Congress. But what I'm suggesting here is that going clear back to the end of World War II, there were a series of decisions made in the executive branch, in the State Department, in the CIA, in the Foreign Aid Agency, in the National Security Council, a series of decisions made on that level, which in my judgment were not properly evaluated in the congressional branch. Somewhere there was a failure of sound judgment. Now, this can't be placed at the door of any one committee or any one administration or any one agency of government. But that whole process needs to be looked at very critically, not to find a scapegoat, but to help us develop a more constructive and dependable policy for the future. I'm not interested in scapegoats in Vietnam. I'm interested in how this country can move out in a more hopeful and more constructive direction in the future.
Senator, we talked a minute ago about the relative silence on Vietnam this year in the Senate. Is part of the reason for that, do you think, an effort by the administration to stifle dissent, to make everybody be quiet?
Perhaps that has had something to do with it. Frankly, in our kind of a free society, I worry about this new emphasis on the part of the administration on the virtues of silence. There has never been a time that I know of in the history of this country when the highest officials in our government have made such a virtue of those people who remain silent. Now, perhaps we ought to be doing more talking, more soul-searching, more questioning about American policy. I think if the recent atrocities indicate anything, it's that we've had too much silence. Here is a terrible crime, if it's true, that was committed almost 2 years ago that we're only now learning about. Where were those who knew about this incident a year and a half ago? Where was the so-called silent majority in the face of the awful reports we've had of the loss of civilian life in Vietnam that have been coming into us for many, many, many years? So it does seem to me that the great emphasis on silence, the effort on the part of high administration officials to intimidate outspoken members of the press, candid television commentators, the effort to isolate those who are involved in the protest against Vietnam, all of those things have perhaps had something to do with the slowing down of real debate over this policy.
And at this point, I'll silence you and slow down our real debate for 1 minute. We'll be back after this message.
This is the house we live in. That's Billy. He's pretty handy to have around. Steve, home from college. Barbie, looking after her brother Timmy. Debbie, who'll soon graduate from high school. Susan, our youngest. And my wife, Peggy, who looks after all of us. And that's me, Bill Thalman, with a friend of mine you might recognize. You know, I didn't really mind losing those courtroom battles, but I'm in a battle right now I don't want to lose at all. Because if I lose it, it means losing my wife and those kids you just met. I've got lung cancer. So take some advice about smoking and losing from someone who's been doing both for years. If you don't smoke, don't start. If you do smoke, quit. Don't be a loser.
Senator McGovern, you talked about further action in Congress, a select committee. How about the national movement for peace? Is it going to stay in the streets? Is it going to take a new direction? And what role will you play in it?
It's my own conclusion, Mr. Herman, and I've thought about this a great deal the last few weeks, that it's not fruitful from here on out to organize large marches or mobilizations any further. I think we've reached the high water mark in terms of the November mobilization, which I regard as largely a peaceful and effective and proper way for large numbers of thoughtful people to show their opposition to the war. But I think it would be self-defeating to repeat that kind of an exercise in December. And I'm pleased to see that the young men who are providing leadership for the so-called moratorium have suggested that in December a different method be used, that they go out into the local communities, into the congressional districts, talk with members of Congress, involve the churches, the local organizations. And I think this is the most hopeful way to approach it. I would expect and I would hope that the 1970 congressional elections, both in the primaries and in the fall, would again raise the issue of American foreign policy and bring the issue to focus within our political process rather than outside of that process.
Senator, some of the people at the moratorium are talking about going to work in a really nuts and bolts political organizing way. Do you see a third party developing out of the peace movement, and would you be interested in one if it did?
No, I don't see a third party emerging, providing one or both of the major parties carry out fundamental reform. This is why I attach such great significance to the reform recommendations that our party has made and which I expect to be carried out. I think we've done very well with the Reform Commission, with a diverse group of people, and I expect to see the Democratic Party become more responsive to the interests of those who now may be flirting with the idea of a third party. Let me add one other point on that. I see many of the young people and older people who are involved in the peace movement turning their attention to some of the great domestic challenges before this country. The great issue of preserving our environment against pollution and contamination may very well be the next chapter in the activist political movement in this country. I think you're going to see this spring on college campuses and in high schools and in communities and all centers of discussion across this country, a new emphasis on improving the quality of life here at home. And I would hope that the issue of the 1970s would turn around the question of how we can move away from foreign adventurism into a new effort in this country to lift the quality of life for all of our citizens.
Senator McGovern, 2.5 years ago, a Senate subcommittee went to Mississippi and reported that Americans were hungry in that state, and later reported hunger all around the country. They called for the president to declare a national emergency. This morning's newspaper headlines have another committee calling on another president to declare a national emergency. What is it going to take for us to do something about the problem of hunger?
Mr. Kotz, I think it's going to take two things. It's obviously going to take the kind of public attention that has been focused on hunger over the past 2 years. I frankly share the impatience of those citizens who think that we've had too much in the way of rhetoric and not enough in the way of action. Nevertheless, I think it was imperative that we have the kind of public attention given to this issue, that is the public spotlight turned on the issue of hunger, which has happened beginning with the Mississippi investigations that you referred to 2.5 years ago. I also think the work of my Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs has been most helpful in alerting the nation to this problem. I would hope that the President's Conference on Nutrition that gets underway this week would serve that purpose. But what is really needed now is legislative action. The most urgent single step that can be taken right now is for the House of Representatives to pass the bill that has already passed the Senate, the massive increase in food stamp assistance that I think can go a long ways towards putting an end to hunger in this country.
What's the principal block, Senator? You'd think that the American people, of all the people in the world, would be the most sympathetic to hunger, would be the people who say, how can we possibly have hunger in this country? And yet the figures that you and others have brought up are anywhere from 5 to 25 million Americans in various degrees of hunger. What stops the nation from turning its attention to this?
Mr. Herman, I think the best answer that I've seen to that, is provided in Mr. Kotz's book, a new book that's coming out, Let Them Eat Promises. We've had the kind of political leadership, both in the executive branch and in the Congress, that has been too much concerned about special interests in this country and not enough concerned about the broad range of human need. That's really the problem.
Well, Senator, you just said that the most important thing that could happen right now would be for the House to pass the food stamp bill that the Senate approved. Is that likely to happen? Is the administration with you?
We've got some, in my judgment, some double talk and some double action going on as far as the administration is concerned. During the time the Senate was debating the food assistance reform bill last fall, the administration, from the vice president on down, were in the Capitol lobbying against the passage of that bill. Once it passed, the next day, the president's press secretary said the president was delighted and that the administration had no plans for any alternative proposal. The full implication of that was that they were going to get behind the passage of this bill in the House of Representatives after it had cleared the Senate. Now, the truth of the matter is that the administration is now circulating a memorandum, which I have a copy of, from the Department of Agriculture, calling for the defeat of the Senate bill, which was my bill, using its influence to defeat that legislation in the House on the grounds that we can't afford it. Now, I say to you that if we can afford the billions of dollars involved in putting a man on the moon in 1969, that we can afford to spend a fraction of that amount putting an end to hunger here in the United States.
Senator.
And I call on the administration to stop this double talk and get behind a serious effort to push that bill through the House of Representatives where it's now blocked.
Senator, isn't there a basic institutional problem in Congress, though? You're a member of the Senate Agriculture Committee. Both the Senate and the House Agriculture Committees have, over the years, repeatedly refused to pass legislation. Do you think that these committees should be left with jurisdiction over whether hungry people get fed?
Well, Mr. Kotz, as you know, in the Senate this year, we overturned the Senate Agricultural Committee on the Senate floor. Now, I want to give Senator Ellender, the chairman of the Senate Agricultural Committee, credit for bringing out a greatly improved bill over what we now have. He's been very attentive both to the work of my committee and to the work of his committee on agriculture. But it is a fact that those two committees in the House and the Senate are much more conservative, in my judgment, than the House and the Senate as a whole. And I do regard them as the principal bottlenecks at the present time to adequate food assistance reform, that plus the lack of real leadership in the executive branch. And I do think a good argument could be made for transferring the permanent jurisdiction of food assistance programs over to those committees that deal with the whole range of health, education, and welfare measures. I think that would be a more proper focus.
Senator, the question of food is largely a question of money, is it not? You have to, either with stamps or with some other kind of cash, you have to buy food. Is the food that we're able to buy today as nourishing per dollar as it ought to be? Is it good, clean, nourishing food?
I think we could do a better job, Mr. Herman, than we have, both in terms of using new techniques to fortify food, to add to its protein and vitamin content. And we could also do a better job on the nutritional front. But that's not the key problem. The key problem is that somewhere between 15 million and 25 million Americans do not have the money to buy a decent diet. Now, we could feed those people adequately with the kind of reformed food assistance legislation that has already passed the Senate. It wouldn't do the entire job, but it would do most of it. We need to combine with a good food stamp program school lunch programs and preschool feeding programs. But for a very small fraction of what we're spending on war, what we're spending on space exploration, we could, in effect, bring an end to hunger and malnutrition in the United States. Let me add this suggestion. I would like to see this country declare, as a matter of national policy, both in the executive branch and in the Congress, that within 1 year's time, we're going to put an end to hunger and malnutrition in the United States. Let's set next Thanksgiving of 1970 as the target date and make that a true Thanksgiving, not just a Thanksgiving for those of us that are overfed, but a Thanksgiving for those millions of people who won't have a table to sit down to at Thanksgiving next year unless you and I act.
How does the amount of hunger relate to the amount of agricultural surplus? In other words, do we have the food to feed these hungry?
Oh, there's no question about it. One of the great tragedies in American life the last 15 years is that we've been worrying about food surpluses and where we were going to put them. We've been paying out hundreds of millions of dollars to store them. We've been paying farmers billions of dollars a year not to produce, and yet we refuse to divert those funds into a program to put an end to hunger.
We don't have much time left, but I just wanted to ask you one question. Some of your speeches here are so fervent, so strongly put, so emotionally put, that they sound a little bit like politics as well as earnest endeavor. Are you going to be a political candidate on the basis of your strongly felt feelings on this and other subjects in 1972?
Well, I'm going to speak out on the issues. I'm not going to wait until 1972, Mr. Herman. I haven't made any judgment about being a candidate, but I have made a judgment to continue speaking out on these issues. And I think the great focus is going to shift to problems right here at home in the years ahead, and I want to be a part of that action.
Thank you very much, Senator McGovern, for being with us here today on Face the Nation.
The Sealy Apostropedic Emissary, Exalted One.
You brought the famous Sealy Apostropedic mattress?
Right here, Your Highness. America's number one firm mattress.
Kindly reveal Posturepedic's secret.
Posturepedic is designed in cooperation with leading orthopedic surgeons for firm support.
Ah, comfortable.
Posturepedic promises no morning backache from sleeping on a too-soft mattress.
Excellent. I'll take it.
King size, queen size, or regular?
One king, 41 queens.
One king, 41 queens? One king, 41 queens?
Posturepedic. Made only by Sealy.
Today on Face the Nation, Senator George McGovern, Democrat of South Dakota, was interviewed by CBS News correspondent Bruce Morton, Nick Kotz of the Washington Bureau of the Des Moines Register and Tribune, and CBS News correspondent George Herman. Next week, another prominent figure in the news will face the nation.